ways that people made sense of it. One is kind of what I would call like sort of Stalin's conception of it, that Marx was supporting the Republican Party and the Union because first the United States needed to go through some kind of democratic user revolution, and then only then it was like ready for socialism. So I have a disagreement with that perspective. And the second is because it opens up discussions about Marxism and race and the black question in the United States, which has been, you know, if you know anything about the left in the US, it's a very controversial issue. So I thought, well, why is Marx interested in the issue of abolishing slavery in the United States to begin with? So with that in mind, I will try not to be like super academic and try to just condense the basic points of what I said. And if by any point I'm like rambling or you don't understand what I'm talking about, just be like, I don't know what the hell that is. And then we can have an open discussion about it. Okay? So I'll start by a little introduction that I think was good just to get us rolling. So Marx was emphatic in his support of the Union in the American Civil War. In many ways, this was the most significant event of the later Marxist life. As Karl Porsch pointed out in the Marxism of the First International written in 1924, for Marx and Engels, the European workers' movement's resistance to British and French intervention on the side of the Confederacy showed that the time was ripe for reestablishing the revolutionary socialist politics they had pursued in 1848. As you know, 1848 is the moment of the Communist Manifesto, it's a moment of upheaval in Europe, revolution. It's also the moment where Marx said, well, okay, so from now on, it's clear that proletarian movement must organize independently from bourgeois, state politics, etc. So again, another issue why this particular position is baffling is because here he seems to support the Republican Party. So why later, after 1848, would Marx do that? However, subsequent history, especially after the defeat of radical Reconstruction, the decades after the Union victory, rendered the American Civil War an ambiguous historical turning point. It did not signal the emancipation of the American and global working class, so much as the rise of the United States as a late industrial power on the backs of largely disenfranchised workers and freedmen. So what does this reveal about Marx's understanding of the bourgeois revolutions, and how does this help us orient toward the trajectory of this history today? So I have two theses. One is that for Marx, the critical support of the Republican North was important for two reasons. One, that the Republican Party was the one that was in power and could actually abolish the slave oligarchy, so the Southern slave oligarchy, which had its paws in all sorts of institutions in the United States, that it was a real power and challenge to this power. The Republican Party could actually defeat them, thus eradicating it as a viable alternative to free labor. So the success of the Republican Party in abolishing the slave power of the South meant defeating slavery as an alternative to free labor in the United States. So number two is that the critical support of the North provided an opportunity for the self-clarification of the historical role of an independent workers' movement of the working class on a global stage. And I think this is particularly important because Marx also has a critique of Lincoln, a critique of the Republican Party, and so he's trying to gather people together to see, okay, so if the Republican Party is not the working class party, if it's something other, then what are we offering in support of this? All right, so in Marx's response to the American Civil War, then, there's an explicit rejection of slave labor. And this is particularly important because in the American South, the ideas of the American South, people usually dismiss it only as being like racist, Southwest. But what's important is that they were defining their slave ideology on the basis that they didn't want the United States to become another Manchester, another sort of destitute, poor working class people that were ruminating the streets and were supposedly vagabonds, etc. So Manchester had become like a really a bad place to be in many ways because the working class wasn't taken care of. And so the slave holding planter class in the South thought, well, this free labor idea, the sort of bourgeois idea of freedom, is overfull. And what you really need is to take care of people who cannot become free laborers, etc. So you need like a paternalistic slave system for this to work. So they were offering it as a different route for modernity, in other words. So they called slavery, in other words, the cornerstone of civilization. So American sociologist George Fitzhugh, who's a very conservative Southerner, basically demanded that people recognize that slavery was the only viable way in which society could reproduce itself. So against that, Marx's call was against slavery and also against the idea that freedom was to be based on inequality. So that's a kind of bourgeois dimension of it. All right, so this call to arms against slavery also holds a radical content, but this radicalism is an extension and supersession, not a rejection against the gains of the liberal tradition. The second dimension of Marxist stance held that insofar as the institution of slavery existed alongside free labor, the historical conflict between proletariat and bourgeoisie would be blunted. And thus, what for Marx was the definitive political confrontation of the modern capitalist epoch would be suppressed by the persistence of slavery. There was a kernel of truth, therefore, by the words of Johnson Calhoun, South Carolina conservative politician, who had pointed out how the American South would be, this is a quote from Calhoun, the American South would be exempt from the disorders and dangers resulting from the conflict between labor and capital. If the South could hold strong to the institution of slavery, Calhoun understood that, quote, after we, the planters, are exhausted, the contest will be between the capitalists and operatives, that is the workers. For in these two classes, it must ultimately divide society. The issue of the struggle here must be the same as it has been in Europe. So in a great, to a great extent, you can see that the Southern planter class was responding to the 1848 revolutions. They thought, really, the conflict in society is between proletariat and bourgeoisie, but by holding on to the institution of slavery, we would actually undermine the possibilities of workers to organize. So slavery was an alternative to free labor, but it was also an alternative of revolutionary politics. Okay, so this part of Marx's claim is therefore bound up with the revolutionary demand. The American Civil War presented a unique opportunity for the clarification of the primary historical task of the international proletariat class, a revolution against capital. Far from the inevitable class struggle between proletariat and bourgeoisie, this demand was at the level of consciousness. When workers in England protested against the Southern Confederacy, Marx noted that they participated against their immediate class interest, that is, of feeding and clothing themselves and their family. Instead, these workers acted from an informed political perspective, from the standpoint of an international working class. So what that means is that there were several upheavals in Europe, including in France, that were supportive of the Confederacy. In fact, the reason for this is because in the textile centers in England, let's say, it would actually undermine the quote-unquote immediate interest of feeding their families for workers to stand with the union against the South. The South, as everyone knows, is extracting cotton, making all the said cotton to England, and that cotton is then used to support the textile manufacturing. Those textile manufacturers would give the livelihood for workers. And so in undermining the Confederacy relationship to England, to a certain extent, workers are actually against their quote-unquote immediate interest for a larger political consciousness of building a revolutionary movement and primarily against slavery. So the point that I'm trying to make here is that sometimes Marx is seen as having a sort of deterministic idea of class consciousness, that by being a worker somehow you immediately find yourself in a radical perspective, we have a revolutionary consciousness. Clearly in this historical example it's not the case, because he's actually saying it is particularly important to organize the First International because you need to actually lead a movement of workers to standing on the correct line against the slave South, even if this means potentially sacrifice the immediate interests. So I think that this part is a sort of controversial point, which I think that should be rescued from the United States American Civil War. So in this light, then, the concept of class consciousness is impossible to sum up as an instinctual response to one's interest as a member of the class, but rather it is the product of a constant political clarification of the historical task of the working class for Marx on the American Civil War. For the purposes of advancing human freedom. So in the age of industrial capitalism, then, new problems of social inequality and limitations to human freedom arose. And although this age was brought about by successful revolutionary efforts of the bourgeoisie, for Marx, the inability to grapple with new forms of inequality and unfreedom within industrial capitalism pointed to a crisis in liberal bourgeoisie. So for Marx, the bourgeoisie had ceased to be revolutionary, although at one point they were a revolutionary class. By the industrial capitalist like period in the 19th century, they had ceased to be so, which means that for him it demanded a new organization, and that new organization was the working class organization. So to the extent that the bourgeoisie was no longer able to do away with barriers to human emancipation, it had ceased to be revolutionary. The international working class movement was tasked to reap the promise of liberal desiderata aspect of this then was in England, Marx, along with others who were involved in First International, the International Working Men's Association, one thing to make clear to the workers was that it was in their long-term interest, it was in the interest of creating a revolutionary international proletariat movement, that they stood against the South and they stood against slavery power. Again, I would emphasize that the ideology of the South is not only based on race, but it's based on the idea that freedom on the basis of equality and on the basis of a kind of revolutionary bourgeois perspective of equality was never to be realized. It couldn't be realized. And they pointed to Manchester as being the example. So you have these poor people who are supposedly free laborers, but society can't actually feed them, they can't clothe them, so this is not freedom. So their definition of freedom was on the basis of inequality. And Marx said that it was important to actually fight this kind of regressive ideology of the South in order to do away with anything that would present an alternative to free labor. So the goal, though, primarily for Marx, was to do away with class conflict. Class conflict is not to be just some sort of eternal projection into the future, but the goal of socialism was, to a great extent, to actually do away with the contradictions of classes in the present. So I think I'll leave it at that. I mean, there's a lot more to say, but maybe we can like have a more sort of conversation about the rest of this stuff. I don't know if anyone has like questions or comments. Yeah, okay.
Okay, so I have a question because part of the history of the agricultural basically after the agricultural revolution to the industrial revolution, American societies were based on slave labor, like I think that part of Marx's idea was that industrialization and the industrial revolution made it possible to like not have a society didn't have to be sustained by slave labor to reproduce itself because people were looking to war with this industrial. So I'm kind of wondering how if that entered into Marx's argument on this, or how much people of the time and then people still need to make a living, and so there's massive unemployment and massive inflation. But I guess there's a special moment that even if Marx is thinking about where there's like a hope for technology.
Yeah. Right? I mean, I think maybe you're presenting like the kind of utopian sort of like dimension of like the introduction of technology seems to like do away with the necessity for manual labor,
yeah.
And at the same time, insofar as society is being reproduced on the basis of the necessity of labor, there's a contradiction. I think that's right. I mean, I think for me, like the curious aspect is how slavery fits into this as well,
right?
Because you know, slavery seems to be like slavery in pre-industrial periods is actually, like Adam Smith noted, much less demanding than slavery within an industrial period. So the kind of like production that's demanded from slaves within an industrial world is incredibly much more demanding, and that's the conditions of slaves are much more than they were before. And so slavery itself is sort of like qualitatively transformed by the presence of free labor. And I think that's the main argument, because another argument around the American South is that it's like feudal or something like this, and like that it like because it has these relationships to land and to planters, that somehow the American South is like a leftover, it's like non-capitalist or something. And Marx actually has a different perspective, which is that, well, look, the character of the American South is actually driven by the fact that free labor exists in England and in other parts of the world. It is only the presence of free labor on an international level that makes the kind of demands that it does in the American South. So, in other words, the shape of the American slavery is actually shaped by the presence of free labor elsewhere. If not, we would be talking like a different system. I think that's an important thing to say. I don't agree that it's like, you know, the pre-capitalist part of the country. If anything, it was extremely capitalist, but without the benefits of free labor.
Should be based on the principle of equality. They're saying that a society
society that's based on the principle of equality is a canard, it's a lie. That society is not equal at all, etc. And that what you have to institute is an institution that recognizes inequality, and for them, that institution is slavery. Something that then have people take care of others, right? Like the slave owners take care of the slaves, etc. But for Marx, importantly enough, the conflict between capital and labor, the conflict between proletariat and bourgeoisie, is the only way in which this historical opening of equality and freedom would come into fruition. And so, whereas the slave planter class and the ideologues of the slave planter class retreat from a historical conflict, Marx wants to actually advance the conflict because he thinks that it's the only way in which new historical conditions are going to come about that actually realize the promises of equality and freedom, etc. I mean, I think that, you know, it might be complicated by what we mean by equality here. Because, of course, like, I don't think Marx was under the understanding that, like, people are actually the same. The idea was, you know, what's the quote, Ross, about, like, the needs and...
Oh, for reason, for example, needs and needs.
Yeah.
People have different needs. They don't have... Like, a blind person has different needs, so not equal needs. Somebody who has working vision. Somebody who has 20/20 vision has different needs than somebody who has worse vision.
Yeah. So the issue is, like, how do we mediate society in such a way that people's needs can be met? But that no one is actually oppressing in terms of a class situation through the needs of others.
I think there's like not within Marx himself, but within the interpretation of Marx, sometimes people misinterpret that cynicism towards the hypocrisy of bourgeois liberalism as like a condemnation of a positive thing, which Marx himself probably would have seen as positive. You know, he obviously praised a lot of what was progressive in bourgeois revolutionary thought. But I think when people interpret Marx, sometimes they misinterpret that kind of cynicism, and it leads them to sort of be reactionary against these kind of positive ideals.
Yeah, I'm trying to find, maybe I'll end on this because we should probably go over there. He writes this letter to Lincoln in which he's giving the support of the International Working Men's Association behind the Republican Party. And he says that the reason why the working men stand behind the Republican Party is because they knew that once the Southerners were claiming that slavery as an institution resolved the problem between labor and capital, the working men knew that the gains made by bourgeois revolutions were under threat. And so it's a kind of response to an attack to previously already earned historical gains that the slave planter sort of attacked. Alright, that should probably figure out what's going on there. Thanks for coming, guys.
Yeah, I gotta work.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Bye, Dave. Have a work.
To get a a sense of like what modernism was reacting to and the needs that it was trying to provide for. I think it's important to bear in mind just the development of the 19th century. I write from a largely Marxist perspective, historically, and one of the problems that Marx and Engels and, you know, other, you know, anarchist and socialist writers at the time were trying to deal with was this immense growth in population. Just, like, staggering. Like, if you have, from the Neolithic Revolution, the founding of settled agriculture, if you have a sort of graph charting population growth over time, it's more or less a kind of even, slight upticks, slight downticks, like, you know, as, like, food shortages and, like, famine and plague broke out. But then once you get to the Industrial Revolution, it's, like, this intense, like, it's, like, a straight spike up. And, you know, ever since, you know, the world is, the population is still growing at this sort of astronomical rate compared to pre-capitalist society. What this raised was problems of housing, problems of shelter that were simply unprecedented compared to traditional society. Whereas there were more or less traditional codified ways of building and low levels of professionalization in terms of the actual like building structures, with the rise of industrialism and the transition out of the town as a sort of commercial and political center to the center of manufacturing and the center of heavy industry, there became what Marx and others called the reserve army of labor. Basically a huge population, but the overproduction of population. Basically a huge mass of people who were structurally unemployable by the system, but yet were generated by it, to an extent sustained by it, though in conditions of intense poverty and degradation. In order to meet this need, there were various attempts to sort of provide sort of makeshift housing for populations that were being basically driven off to the countryside through enclosure, through any number of agricultural reforms that led to what we have today as, you know, sort of mass industrialized agriculture. And so there was a sort of large influx of population from the countryside to the city. Most of the people who were there who ended up moving to the city suffered, you know, from, or were forced into tenement houses. Tenements being this kind of like ramshackle, very low life expectancy and basically crammed in, and it had all of those disruptive effects on the traditional structures of the family. But Marx and the modernists in architecture realized this had sort of revolutionary implications for what society could look like, and really, you know, the abolition of the family form, the ending of property relations, the destruction and the abolition of primogeniture. This is something in the French Revolution, which was considered like by traditionalists, by the Catholics and Jesuits, to be sort of anathema. Was that the French Revolution banned or got rid of required or compulsory primogeniture, by which the eldest male son inherits everything. So there was divisible property, and as a result, the sort of nuclear family, in which multiple generations lived within the same household, a child usually took up the trade or craft of his father, you know, became married into domestic slavery, as Marx put it. For Marx, marriage was just a form of property relations. Like, basically, it was like, by what your wife becomes your property under bourgeois, I mean, under pre-bourgeois and bourgeois property relations. It's like, she's your property to have, like, sole sexual gratification. It also had some religious frills and dressings. Like, it was considered a sort of sacred bond. You still hear this with traditionalists about the sort of the sacred institution of marriage. But this is largely the situation that Engels was trying to respond to in the late 19th century, the housing question. I mean, there's also this kind of division between town and the city, and the way it presented this kind of transformative moment where it collapses kind of the town and the country, you move beyond this kind of this disruptive kind of workforce that they were pushing through the city. Dissolve all this poverty, so solve it, try to fix it. Would be housed, unemployed, would be this. I mean, like, the city of the 19th century, at least the working class, not the central of the historic cities, which is happening in the south, at least in Paris, maybe it's across the country. The center of the street of the city has always been and continues to this day to be happening. Very the fringe areas of the city are kind of large workers or laborers, and which even Manfredo Tafuri, who's an Italian Marxist architecture writer, like he pointed out over and over again that the center of the city, his own capital, the walls of capital, the workers, all the oppressed are moved out to the fringe. So you get kind of these ramshackle, at least by the 19th century, with industry, this kind of really sickening development of like overcrowded housing that modernist architects will look back and think of. They developed kind of a really hard hard side towards this kind of pestilent expression or excellent living conditions that form. And so the modernist urbanist solution, or one of the core tenets of modernist urbanism, would be the combination to his person via minimal goal, but also the access to each person, regardless of the class, to have access to fresh air, sunlight. Those three tenants are to be found in every object possible. From the early teens, 20s, even today, I think it's kind of possible to
Yeah, I mean, it's useful to contrast this too. I mean, there were, like, historically there were, like, the countryside was associated with a certain number of problems that then it became romanticized later after massive urbanization. But before that time, and even, you know, during the early 20th century, the countryside was looked at as a sort of den of intense hierarchy, ignorance, patriarchy, religious superstitions, and relatively low lifespan without any sort of, like, mobility. One basically grew up and stayed in the same place, never expanded their horizons. There was very little in the sense of individual sort of bourgeois subjectivity, which is more associated with what we've all went through, having jobs, when we grow up, basically not being tied to one form of craft or anything like this. But with the move towards massive urbanization in the 19th century, there are all these different problems that then made the countryside look like a sort of like paradise. And you still get this in certain sort of like throwback romanticist circles, back to the land movements, where, you know, one feels that city life, and usually this is symptomatically something that urbanized intellectuals, tend to have a sort of romantic moment of wanting to return to the land as to connectedness and providing for oneself sort of self-sustaining agriculture and so on, wanting to return to a sort of pre-capitalist moment. But I mean, the reasons for this were, I mean, historically understandable. Intense like smokestacks and heavy congestion of traffic in and out throughout the city, incredibly crowded, intense overcrowding of spaces, and
what was associated with this stylistically, even in the upper class houses, the sort of massive cavernous houses that one thinks of in terms of like 19th century mansions, was this overcrowding of stuff, like the sort of Victorian apartment. I don't know if you watch all of like Sherlock Holmes BBC productions, but like if you do, you'll notice that there are these very sort of dark, dreary apartments, like, I mean, very ornamental stuff just like packed on. I see that Victoria just came down. How was the occupation?
Huh?
How was the occupation?
Y'all keep
upstairs?
Yeah. They're very heated themselves in.
Okay.
Oh, I thought you were
going to. Oh, okay, alright. Different Victoria, alright.
Yeah.
I thought it was Victoria.
She went for the capsule of the flag.
Yeah.
Okay, alright. Well, best of luck to them.
That was scary because we just had Victoria. I was like, oh my god, already.
No. Not yet.
No,
okay.
Not yet.
Anyway, so, I mean, this is usefully contrasted. So, the sort of dark, like, dimly lit and sort of like encrusted with all of these, like, you know, Persian rugs and all this sort of, like, you know, miniatures, just like, photographs lining every single inch of the wall is often contrasted with the sort of like blank white wall of modernism, which one can find in the UCA. So, I mean, I think it's when you look at looking at those living conditions, it's just reminiscent. Modernist architecture, at least I get to look at Luce from 1910, the famous essay called Ornament and Cloud. It's degenerate, yeah. And so he goes into all kinds of kind of weird racial races. Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is, yeah, I mean, well, I think it's like, what's interesting with Luce is, well, I mean, at least Luce, is, if you look at all his projects, the exterior facades, vertical buildings, including like, within the school, inside is the opposite effect of Luce, because he's a modernist, but not a Luceist. Because when you look at his exterior, it's completely blank. You never know. You don't know what that building says, but you don't know what the values are attached to it. But you walk inside, and it's this very elaborate, even fetishistic Victorian kind of aspect. The inside, the interior is the domain of the individual who lives. The exterior belongs to the city, where more ornamentation is. The thing for Luce, the way he talks about ornamentation and being a degenerate kind of quality of this kind of industrial field.
And there's a contradiction too, because they were using mass production to produce sort of like really sort of excessive ornamental.
Yeah. Which is the case. Yeah, you're building, I mean, look at any structure, any ornamental structure. From, you know, past the 50th to 50th, anything was. The ornamentation was mass produced. And so the same shell of the modernism was mass produced.
You're talking about individual houses as like people's generic elevation to have a blank space, have a white wall. But earlier you were talking about larger systems, poverty, pride, and these, I think, like with modernism, play more into much larger actions than you do have very blatant. It's like Robert Wilson's highway, which cuts through the Bronx and causes the highest asthma rates in the country.
No, I mean, that's definitely
that's like a very.
Well, I mean, at the basis of the. That's the problem. That comes from the 60s. But I mean, it has to do with like. You get this introduction of, I mean, this kind of core. Like these early manifestos of modernist planning. Where it's definitely reactionary because. Each one of these projects take on like a kind of solarium aesthetic or solarium paradigm, which would literally cure the city and cure the workers of the harm and sickness that, you know, has been kind of indebted to them. I mean, kind of.
Yeah, one of the things that's, I mean, it's true, like, there are.
Can you guys, like, talk a little louder?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's one of the contradictions
of sort of modern cities is that, yes, I mean, they're all these associated health problems, but at the same time, life expectancy always goes up when people move from the countryside to the city because there's a higher density of, like, healthcare professionals, doctors, medicine. Whereas out in the countryside, it was typical that, I mean, you see these old movies where, like, you have to send for the doctor who lives, like, a town away. I mean, countless people died or, like, were unable to be cared for because hospitals, as we think of them, simply did not exist. Or if they did, they were attached to religious institutions. I think, like, bracketing Robert Moses in the sort of later, sort of, capitalist appropriation of modernism, because it's very unclear. I mean, we should be...
Well, modernism in the U.S. takes a little bit of
time. Yeah. Like, we should be very clear that modernism itself is not a political, an inherently political position. It's very politically amorphous. It tended early on to lend itself to a sort of, like, agnostic socialism. Like, a sort of idea of, you know, like, wanting to have a sort of, like, unified plan of how to lay out entire structures and cities. Metaphors that was used was to explain the irrationality of capitalist society and sort of competing interests that sort of conflicted with one another and were mutually antagonistic was to use the example of traffic jams. The car had just been invented around then. The idea was that, you know, why did these traffic jams in older cities like Paris and Rome, and the roads were installed and not designed for. And second of all, I mean, there were people trying to cut each other off in such a way, maybe, where they, you know, if somebody wants to get onto, you know, the turn or whatever, like, there are all these problems that arise simply because of mass interests, individual interests, without any sort of broader view to the functioning of the system. So free flows, decongested systems built on roads were actually designed to handle something like an automobile. Rome, Paris, and all these other cities simply were not designed to move.
Which is why, I mean, you get people like Corbusier wanting to tear down most of Paris to rationalize it, to rationalize a medieval city as it was. I mean, Osman did that to a certain degree.
Yeah, I mean, so it's kind of interesting. Like, the main inspiration for modernist architecture, I mean, it's twofold. My argument, I've got a book that's coming out, on modernism, specifically in the Soviet context. But formally, there were two main inspirations. There was largely an American inspiration built up around, like, sort of factory architecture, even in New York, particularly Chicago and Buffalo. Like, they had these incredibly utilitarian, functional, but, you know, they worked, sort of, grain silos and factories.
Car factories too. Detroit.
Yeah, Detroit. That's another great example of, because we're kind of seeing it in reverse right now. A city that kind of sprung up overnight. Detroit, like 120, 130 years ago, was just farmlands. It's kind of turning back into farmlands right now because of just, like, intense urban degradation. But overnight, it became, like, the center of world automobile production. Like, within a couple decades, I mean, it was mind-blowing in terms of, like, a city sort of just popping up overnight. So, like, in terms of formal innovation, a lot of the examples came from Louis Sullivan, Frank Lloyd Wright in Chicago, and from industrial factory production. Then another major visual, in terms of visual aesthetics, the innovation of abstract art. Siegfried Gideon has a kind of problematic, but I would say generally correct, even if he misidentifies the forces, emphasis on space, time, a sort of modern sense of space and time exemplified by, on the one hand, cubism, abstract art, sort of reformatting the way that we visually make sense of the city, and make sense of our existence, and futurism in terms of temporality. So, this sort of, like, accelerating pace of city life,
And so, like, these two influences, industrial machine production, ergonomics, basically making spaces that were actually efficient, where it's what they call perambulation, where you could actually move and get to one part of the house efficiently, like sort of clear corridors without like sort of crowded overhangs or anything like that. But yeah, so like with these two formal pillars, I would say, then the sort of social content of modernist architecture was largely to address these problems of lack of housing, poverty. And I mean, one thinks of like the sort of modernist houses, again, like in terms of the sort of horror that they became in the second half of the 20th century, and with sort of the sort of barons of Keynesian Fordist capitalist production, like Robert Moses and so on. And then you get like somebody like Jane Jacobs, which is sort of like response, in her own way, somewhat problematic, but reacting to capitalist modernism. But there was a moment in modernism's foundation where they were generally concerned with solving social problems and being part of a revolutionary transformation they felt was affecting all of society. I mean, it was intensely apocalyptic, even. Like, whereas today there's a lot of emphasis, Owen Hatherley, blogger and author of a book called Militant Modernism, has this bit on the city of Hamburg in Germany. These sort of twin competing leftist utopias. The 1920s social democratic Siedlung, which was a sort of settlement, where they, I mean, it was kind of piecemeal or enclaves, as Tafuri would term them, but they were like, the idea was that you sort of create a blank canvas. What Sammy was talking about with Le Corbusier and Le Plan Voisin, it's amazing if you see it, because like you see the sort of rough outline of Paris, but it's been all the old buildings have been completely knocked down. Louvre, knocked down. Notre Dame, knocked down. In place, like these like sort of terrifying huge structures, the Cartesian towers that you described. I mean, it was a provocation, obviously, but the idea was that the old world's work, all the sort of accumulated detritus of dead epochs is finally coming to an end. We want to build a new world on its ashes, on the ashes of people. Whereas today there's a kind of shift away from the Siedlung, the social democratic Siedlung, and away from the sort of Marxist communist Sozialgesellschaft, or socialist city, towards the sort of anarchist squat of the sort of 1980s, 1990s, and 2000s, where largely, I mean, there is sort of like drifters, punk and post-punk culture, sort of wanting to use creative reuse of old structures. What's kind of odd, what Hatherley points out, is that they largely shied away from the actual social democratic workers' housing, stuff that was actually designed for the working class, not these sort of like incredibly decadent, rich households. They actually took over mostly these old Wilhelmine structures, like built under the Kaiser. Like, so it's this kind of weird, like. I'm convinced that this is where a lot of steampunk and cyberpunk comes from. This kind of weird juxtaposition of safety pins and leather and these kind of like Victorian ensembles. But yeah, I mean, in the middle of the Owen Hatherley. He runs a blog called Nasty, Brutalist, and Short. A reference to Thomas Hobbes. Nasty, Brutalist, and Short. Yeah.
I mean, I think there are classes to modernism that you brought up. I mean, there's American modernism, there's also late post-war modernism, where you see a lot of these ambitious housing projects that even in New York, it's kind of, at least all the way up. Mostly concrete housing structures that now people think fail tremendously and never function. But then you also get like that first initial sprout of modernism, which is in the Soviet context very much based on this concept and this conception of a new society, where, you know, any revolutionary views intoxicated all artists to a degree. But architecture itself, there's this kind of...
There's a spirit.
I think it's a science fiction quality to architecture. I always think it's different because now, I mean, contemporary architects don't feel that kind of, neither their urgency nor the kind of... every architect is on the Whereas the most spectacular thing about the, at least the initial modernist period, is that I've been through the late 30s, beginning of the first modern period. Architects from every nationality were kind of, you know, joining together to solve the tool that was architecture. So you get this kind of, aesthetic.
A sort of social mission, and felt that it had a sort of social and historic mandate, basically, to create this new society in which the needs of all would be provided in a rational way, without the sort of like the barbarism of the capitalist city, the idiocy of rural life, as Marx had put it. And so there was this moment. I mean, there was.
Once you bear in mind, there were a confluence of forces, of course. Like, after the First World War, there was the Russian Revolution, which was never intended to be just the Russian Revolution. It was an attempt to foment world revolution in the minds of like Lenin, Trotsky, Kamenev, and all the others. They envisioned the Russian context as a kind of start for a more general European revolution in the major industrialized countries, from which then a sort of world socialist society could be manifested. The fact that we call it the Russian Revolution today is a sign that it failed. But in the aftermath of that, there was a split within Marxism, the Second International. There were social democratic parties in Austria, in particularly in Vienna, and in France, and in Germany, that became the sort of preeminent like representative bodies of the people. I mean, later they were forced out by more conservative wings, and eventually most of them capitulated or were defeated, overwhelmed by fascism, which incidentally Mussolini even himself started out as a socialist organizer.
It's another facet of modernism. There is a fascist modernism.
Yeah, there is a fascist modernism, though it's, again, like fascism, I don't think is intelligible without the sort of reference point of socialism, because fascism is a sort of an intensely reactionary moment trying to plunge civilization back into darkness, away from the barbarism of capital, and away from the sort of, you know, hopes of socialism, sort of cosmopolitan entity, you know, universe. I mean, there were all of these. Hans Meyer, who is a communist, is the second director of Bauhaus. Usually forgotten because he's in between Walter Gropius and Mies van der Rohe, who are, you know, two of the greatest modernists in the 20th century. Hans Meyer, he had this bit in 1926 where he said, you know, we're all driving these fast cars, we're all moving on airplanes, like, we're all learning to speak Esperanto. Mm-hmm. Esperanto is this universal language cobbled together from all the existing languages. And the idea was that we're all going to learn how to speak one language. We're going to be one humanity, not separate nationalities, not separate races, not separate like genders. We're going to be one free humanity.
Which, I mean, it takes on a very central for gender politics too. But,
I mean, the idea that architecture could kind of split the traditional family to free the mother, to free the world from domestic slavery.
Yeah,
you get these plans for all types of housing, but housing that is more of a collective social event, so you have different services, communal kitchens, play areas, kindergartens, all built into the actual housing facility. So that these are like kind of towns themselves. It's like a closely knit community within this one structure. this kind of paternalistic, well, this definitely is
an easy civilization. So even like in the, even a sort of like, even early, I mean, Walter Gropius was never a radical. He was at most a kind of pseudo-socialist. The way that he understood civilization progressing was the age of the family, which was basically from settled agriculture on, being the sort of age of demand, like the sort of dominant male household figure, who then, you know, basically had his children and his wife as slaves subject to his will. Property that was a bit more or less dispensable. Usually there was some favoritism towards the eldest son, as the successor and heir. With Gropius said that, you know, the age of the individual, modern bourgeois society, opens up the opportunity for the age of the woman. There became movements for women's suffrage, for women's ability to vote, sort of having a sort of separate identity from the man that one was married to, having an independently viable basis for social reproduction, being able to get a job. And what that meant for modernist architecture was, how do we eliminate the sort of the domestic servitude, the sort of drudgery of household that basically prevent women from seeking independent employment? There were all these irrationalities to the old housing and things that could be solved through collective laundries, mass cafeterias. They wanted to get rid of, at its most radical, there was a planning in Wayne he wanted to basically realize the Platonic ideal in Plato's Republic of taking children away from their families at birth, having them raised separately so that there was no sort of family identification. Everybody identified with each other as brother and sister, and everybody older than them was like mother and father. That basically would, so like they would be raised separately together, but in a way that women didn't have to stay home and care for children most of their lives.
It wasn't as scary as it sounds either. I mean, the parents and the children would see each other in the mornings and then after work. They were completely separate from their family. But I mean, also this whole kind of politics manifests spatially in the fact that the husband and wife do not see each other. Each one is allowed to have a child. I think that's also very much more inexpressible than a new kind of society. I mean,
it's like something that you've never seen before. I mean, in the last generation, at least in the US, I mean, in the major industrialized countries of the world, when you see still some vestiges of older like family relations and more traditional societies. But the sort of last generation of like elder individuals who grew up sleeping in the same bed as their sister, or like, I mean, certainly in the early 19th century, basically the entire family basically sharing one room. Like, imagine how different that is in terms of like individual identity formation, subjectivity formation. Having a room of one's own, as the famous novel put it. There's a gloss on this by that guy, Owen Atherley. There's this very, very ambitious, very science fiction-y plan for urban resettlement, socialist resettlement, in which houses that themselves would not be tied down in the earth. One would be given these sort of mobile pods in which each individual had his or her own pod. They were mobile. Those who you wanted to associate with, you could associate. If you got married to somebody, you could connect to the pods. It is sort of a larger, more utopian basis than the sort of bed.
But it's a different apartment. It's a different part, yeah. It's a different part of socialism, because on the one hand, you have where you have social connections, those that are open to collectivism, then we have the disconnects. we're also at the same time socialist, but highly individualist, which you would normally associate with how people tell you. So you have these kind of two, yeah. I mean, urbanist one, and the end of the day, urbanist one.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, again,
I mean, it speaks to the kind of
diversity
and richness of socialism that it, for most instances.
Yeah, I mean, because of the sort of Stalinist aftermath, sort of idea of sort of like beehive collectivism, one often loses sight of the fact that for Marx, for Engels, for August Bebel, and Lenin, Luxembourg, and Trotsky, collective, individual freedom can only be realized through collective freedom. If one had to worry about, you know, one's immediate needs constantly having to work 60 to 70 hours a week, because people do often underground in the city of today, one doesn't really even have this free time to cultivate one's own individuality. So, I mean, there are these two poles, basically, the disurbanists, Mikhail Akitovich of the Soviet Union, versus the urbanists who themselves want smaller cities, which still more collectivized building arrangements. Lenin Subsovich and the Vesnin brothers, they had this idea, like, they wanted to negotiate these various contradictions that manifested themselves in capitalist society. Contradiction between individual desires and social well-being, between nature and access to sort of natural light and sort of you know, clean air and access to sort of like the modern culture, basically. The kind of city nightlife stuff that doesn't exist at all in sort of like backwards rural parts of the world. They wanted to negotiate between collective and individual freedom. They wanted to negotiate between nature and culture. They wanted to negotiate between town and country. What they envisioned, I mean, it's kind of sad that, you know, that after the sort of Stalinist turn, the system during which modernism was looking in favor of this kind of grotesque sort of hybrid structures of gargantuan monumentalism, like pillars and like statuary and like gigantic statues of Stalin and Lenin and so on, but made in like past moves of concrete. Like it wasn't just a return. Stalinism wasn't just a return to pre-modernist. And I've written an essay, a review that's going to be coming out in spring called Stalinism, one of the first postmodern style. Because literally, Stalinism was postmodern in the sense that it came after modernism in the Soviet Union. It happened faster than in the West, which was kind of aligned to the fact that the Soviet Union was historically somewhat backwards in terms of its industrial development. At least early on. The thing that's interesting is that the Stalinist return to neoclassicism was very particularly like informed by modernism. They you get like skyscrapers, the Seven Sisters in Moscow, for example, this sort of huge wedding cake structures, like gargantuan, but with very sort of traditional looking like ornamentation. And it's a really sort of reverse blend, like this sort of like old like throwback historical references, and then gigantic scale and very modern, like reinforced concrete. So
you see that in dust.
Yeah, exactly.
And spears.
Yeah.
Could be described as a
yeah, but using very classical coolness. Yeah. Anyway, to sort of wrap up and just sort of like highlight the main points, modernism at the outset, because like there was a sort of break that I want to pause between from the move away from traditional society and towards the formation of the avant-garde in architecture, to a sort of break within politicized modernism, the sort of socio-historic mission of modernism.
versus the sort of post-war aftermath, in which basically all the modernists that had been kicked out of Germany and then moved to the Soviet Union, there were tons of them, then moved to the United States or in parts to Israel, and, you know, became sort of a high modernist, building sort of the chic dwellings of Greenwich, Connecticut, or, you know, sort of corporate lofts and so on. Yeah, exactly. It's one of the kind of sad contradictions that somebody like Nisander, early in his youth, built the monument to Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg, who were two communist heroes who were killed by a proto-fascist tribe. But then 30 years later, he was the same architect who designed the swankiest monument to high forces capitalists. Anyway, classical modernism, sort of early avant-garde, concerned itself with solving these social and historic problems that existed within modern society that had been generated by the transition of modernity, but themselves, but they felt modern society contained the answers to these problems, and potentially a world in which women could exist separately from families, from their husband, they would have the freedom to work and cultivate themselves apart from any sort of property relationships. There would be housing available to all those, you know, in society. There wouldn't be these sort of cramped spaces depicted in 19th century urban rural crusades. There would be a new sort of unity, a sort of classical unity to the aesthetic experiences. There wouldn't be this sort of jumble of sort of contradictory structures that were largely created by the fact that architects were bound to sort of individual clients, which, like, because, again, like, the competing interests, there would be no sort of harmony to layout or overall design and city, it would instead just be this sort of agglomeration of separate structures in ways that were often very contradictory, that built over old structures. So I mean, there was this sort of cohesiveness to the modernist project early on that gets lost somewhat later. And certainly the postmodernists moving out of modernism, well, they have, like, in terms of their urbanism, some commitment to sort of, like, rhizomatic reproduction of, like, existing social structures in ways that are supposedly subversive or resistance to sort of hegemonic capitalism. They have a sort of defensive posture, or, you know, they're just straightforwardly indulgent of sort of, like, incredibly. There's a Frank Gehry structure, and I like Frank Gehry's, but it was supposed to be a low-income housing, like, a building. But of course, like, yeah. But, I mean, of course, like, Frank Gehry already, he was Frank Gehry, he knew who he was, like, acclaimed. Word got out that it was Frank Gehry who designed this low-income housing building, so there were some units that were, like, mandated by law because of the nature of the building to be low-income. Like, these, and, you know, people were selected as being able to, like, get to live, getting to live in this, like, Frank Gehry designed building. But then the other lofts, like, sort of offset the costs, were inhabited by these fabulously wealthy individuals, kind of, like, defeating the entire purpose of what the low-income housing units were supposed to provide.
Up there in elevators.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. They get to sort of, yeah.
I mean, I think the saddest architects that could,
wait, what? Well, I believe in a classless society, so... I believe in a classless society, so... I'm trying to lay things out from a Marxist perspective.
Okay.
So, I mean, insofar as Marxism and
earlier forms of socialism, earlier socialized versions of anarchism, believed in the sort of creation, foundation of a classless society, one in which there weren't these intense social antagonisms of experience and wealth, or the necessity of work, you know, 60 to 70 hours a week. This would be the kind of society that, I mean, these kinds of divisions or antagonisms are not the best. I mean, I agree there is a sort of perversity to some of gentrification, which are like, oh, you know, the poor housing should just be for the poor, you know, they shouldn't have, like, rich people move in and then drive up costs, which is admittedly horrible, like...
We're also getting into a kind of weird paradigm where architects like Frank Gehry have learned that they can build essentially low-income houses and sell them to incredibly wealthy people.
Of course, I mean, he was contracted to build this thing.
I mean, even though, like, the Manhattan Frank Gehry project uses the same construction technique as the, like, traditional concrete residency with the other facade, but he's able to sell it for $1 million apartments.
I mean, I think this is part of the Stark effect.
Yeah, yeah, like,
I mean, he could design whatever he wanted as long as he's able to spend it.
Right.
Which is a sad thing, especially for architects, and even there is, I mean, generally speaking, there is no social mandate or responsibility to society.
Well, just before we leave, we've got an event coming up at NYU on, I don't know if we've got posters for it.
I think they're all given away.
Okay, yeah, we gave them away. It's December 6th. It's on the aftermath of the election, about a month after. It's called The Future of the Status Quo. We're going to be having panelists, writers for Jacobin Magazine and The North Star and Revolution newspaper talk about basically the left after the election, what prospects for radical organizing, leftist organizing are in light of this re-election of Obama.
That's right. The address is 60 Washington Square South, room 804. And it's at 7 p.m. this Thursday.
Which building is
that? It's called the Kimmel Center, the NYU Kimmel Center. 60 Washington Square South.
Yeah, it should be really great. Interesting panelists.
Really,
yeah, we have a publication. We do coffee breaks.
Which one?
We do reading groups on the weekends. And yeah, if you're interested in this kind of stuff, we're also putting together a panel in February.
We're doing an architecture panel in February. Peter Eisenman is on it. Hopefully everything will line up. So far, Peter Eisenman.
Yeah, Peter Eisenman's agreed. My first like free university gig.
Yeah.
Thanks, Sam. 50?